auditorium, but Lisbet replaced it with an antique drafting table that she found at Brimfield.
Good evening, Lisbet hears Mario say. Subiaco, party of two?
Lisbet is hiding behind him, trying to summon her affirmations.
What are they? She can't remember a single one, not even the silly one about the pineapple.
She hears Christina's voice, and while she's too addled to listen to the exact words, she can tell Christina is fawning.
My name is Christina. So honored to... I'll tell Chef. Please let me show you.
Mario ushers Lisbet forward. Girl, yes, Lisbet thinks. She smiles at Christina and says,
Hey there, how's it going?
Never underestimate the element of surprise. Christina doesn't seem to recognize Lisbet at first. Ha ha, no braids. But then it lands, and Christina's eyes ricochet between Mario and Lisbet. She fumbles the menus, and one drops to the floor. Lisbet watches as Christina crouches to retrieve it while trying to make sure her very short, very tight black skirt doesn't hike up her ass. Christina leads them to the corner table closest to the water, table number one, also known as Dirty Harry. It's not surprising that this is where they're sitting, considering that, for JJ, Mario Subiaco ranks right up there with God, Santa Claus, and Clint Eastwood. Though now, Christina is probably wishing she could pivot and put them at table 24 in the opposite corner, or even inside. Mario pulls out Lisbet's chair, and Christina hands them menus and says,
We have a Whispering Angel Rosé fountain here at the deck. We sell our signature wine glasses for $50 apiece. They're yours to take home, and you may have as many glasses of the rosé as you'd like.
Lisbet stares at Christina. Is she actually giving Lisbet the spiel when Lisbet was the one who dreamed up the idea for the rosé fountain in the first place? When Lisbet was the one who repurposed a salvaged garden fountain that she bought from Marty McGowan, the Sconset gardener? That fountain is hers, not Christina's. How dare Christina do this? She's either clueless or being catty. Mario waits until Christina's finished, then reaches across the table and squeezes Lisbet's hand.
Thanks for that, Tina. Would you mind giving us a second?
Christina blinks. I'm also the sommelier here, so...
Lisbet nearly squawks. What happened to Goose? Did JJ fire him so that Christina could take over the sommelier job? She realizes she's crushing Mario's fingers and she eases up a bit. She reminds herself it's no longer any of her business.
So let me bring by the wine list.
Not just yet, Tina, thanks, Mario says.
Take the hint, Tina, Lisbet thinks. Scram. Christina lingers and then very distinctly addresses only Mario. She touches the sleeve of his beautiful blue blazer with her French manicured fingers. Lisbet realizes that it's not beyond Christina to throw herself at Mario.
I know Chef will want to come out and say hello.
Mario keeps his eyes locked on Lisbet's. Thank you. Another few beats pass while Christina tries to figure out what's going on. Finally, Lisbet gives Christina a look like a harpoon through the lungs.
Thank you, Christina.
Christina takes a stutter step back, and Lisbet's eyes follow, thinking she's going to fall into table three, which is occupied by Ari and Lyric Layton. Ari and Lyric are deep in conversation, and Lyric is upset, wiping at her eyes, so they don't notice Christina, who rights herself at the last minute, nor do they appear to see Lisbet. When Christina finally heads back to her station, Mario says,
Should we get out of here?
Yes, Lisbet says,
and they go. Back in Mario's truck, Lisbet isn't sure whether to laugh or cry.
Laugh, she thinks, and she does.
They walked out of the deck holding hands, Mario leading the way, Lisbet ignoring all the people calling after her. When they reached the front, they encountered Christina and JJ having a whisper fight. Christina no doubt saying something to the effect of,
Mario Subiaco showed up with Lisbet. They were rude to me.
Christina's back was to Mario and Lisbet, but JJ saw them and said,
Whoa, hey, are you leaving, Chef?
Mario stopped.
We're going someplace where the service is a bit more polished. He saluted JJ. Good to see you again. JJ followed them out the door. Wait, he said. Lisbeth, come on, don't be like this. Mario held the passenger door of his truck open, and Lisbeth climbed in. She waved at JJ as they pulled out. She doesn't know where they're going. She doesn't care. Mario heads into town, where people are out and about in full July revelry. There's a group of young women having a bachelorette party. Families, happy couples, and one couple arguing, which reminds Lisbeth of seeing the Laytons. Lyric Layton, who is one of the calmest, most zen people Lisbeth knows, was crying at the deck. Something must have been very wrong. Lisbeth suspects Mario is taking her to the club car, but they bump over the cobblestones of Main Street, so then she thinks they must be going to Nautilus. Then they pass Nautilus and Lisbeth thinks, Lola? She's with Mario Subiaco, the former king of the Nantucket restaurant world. They'll be able to walk in anywhere. Mario pulls down the white shell lane behind Old North Wharf and parks in a spot marked Residents Only. He says, I probably should have checked with you. Is it okay if I cook for you at my place? He smiles. He's so fine, Lisbeth thinks. Now that JJ and Christina have been properly humiliated, she feels energized and nervous for another reason. She's on a date with Mario Flipping Subiaco. He's going to cook for her. He leads her past the cute cottages of Old North Wharf, past the famed Wharf Rat Club, past Provisions and the Straight Wharf restaurant on the right. Where are they going? And out a rickety dock over the water. Lisbeth watches where she puts her feet on the old uneven boards, thinking in her emotionally heightened state that she could easily topple into the harbor, where her wedges would anchor her right to the bottom. The dock leads out to a lone cottage, and Lisbeth looks around. How in 15 years has she never realized this little place was here, floating on pillars in the middle of the harbor? To the left are the grand homes of Easton Street and Brant Point Light, and to the right, she can see and hear the people eating on the porch at Straight Wharf. Mario opens the door, and they step back in time. The cottage feels like something out of what Lisbeth vaguely thinks of as the good old days, that era in the 1950s and 1960s when properties were both loved and neglected, when summer homes were passed down through families and not purchased online for eight figures, thanks to the dazzling 360-degree photo gallery. The cottage features a boxy, wood-paneled room that smells of the sea. There's a gray tweed sofa and two upright armchairs, a braided rug, a dinged-up dining room table with mismatched chairs, a kitchen with brown cabinets, formica countertops, a four-burner electric stove, and a white icebox with a long pull handle. There are some truly atrocious oil paintings hanging on the walls. Lisbeth squints. They're landscapes of Nantucket, no doubt the efforts of one of the former owners who took a summer's interest in rendering the island en plein air. She can tell without checking that in the cabinets, she will find Junior League and Congregational Church cookbooks stained with cranberry sauce and clam juice, as well as a speckled black lobster pot and a box of frilled toothpicks purchased sometime during the Kennedy administration. Off to the left is a door that leads to a bedroom, low bed, covered with a patchwork quilt, and another door that leads to a bathroom tiled in iridescent pink. It must have been renovated in the 70s. This is fabulous, Lisbeth says. Mario sheds his blazer and kicks off his flip-flops.
I'm glad you like it. Some people wouldn't understand. They wouldn't get it.
He has brought Lisbeth's cooler bag from the truck and he pulls out the bottle of Krug.
Let me show you the best part.
He grabs two jelly jars from the cabinet, hands them to Lisbeth, they're painted with cartoon scenes from Tom and Jerry, and opens a door that leads out to his, well, Lisbeth supposes it's his front porch. It's a covered deck that overlooks Nantucket Harbor. Water laps up against the pilings beneath their feet. A ladder hangs off the railing. How, she says, did you get this?
Xavier, Mario says, I was on the fence about working at the bar, but then he dangled this place and I caved.
He expertly takes the cage off the Krug and gently pulls the cork. He pours the champagne into the jelly jars, then he and Lisbeth face each other and touch glasses.
This is more like it, Mario says. Here's to you, heartbreaker.
By their second glass, they're sitting next to each other on a wicker love seat on the deck, bare feet up on a wrought iron table, gazing out at the darkening sky. The red beacon of Brant Point Light glows, then dims.
How did you get to Nantucket from Minnesota? Mario says. I don't think you've told me.
Well, Lisbeth says, when I was at the University of Minnesota, there was a girl in my dorm who showed up to school a week late. All we knew about her was that her name was Elise Perryvale, and she was from out east. None of us could understand why anyone would miss the first week of freshman year. Lisbeth sips her champagne. She was tan and had this sun-bleached hair, and she was wearing faded jean shorts and boat shoes that looked like they'd been repeatedly run over by a vintage Jeep Wagoneer. And she said, "Sorry I'm late. My parents wanted to eke out one more week at our house on Nantucket."
"Did you hate her?" Mario asks.
"I worshipped her," Lisbeth says. I thought that was the most seductive sentence I'd ever heard. We were from Minnesota. Summertime for us was going to our lake cabins and waiting in line for Sweet Martha's at the state fair. And here was this mermaid among us. I asked her all about Nantucket, and she lent me a Nancy Thayer novel, which I devoured. The summer after I graduated, I moved out here and got a job waiting tables at the deck, which was brand new that year. I started dating JJ, and 15 years passed.
You never wanted to get married?
When I met JJ, I was too young to get married. Then we became sort of anti-establishment. We wanted to be like Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell. We thought getting married would kill the romance. But JJ killed it a different way.
I take it Tina is the new girlfriend?
Mario says. Christina, yes. Our former wine rep. A woman I used to like. Lisbeth tells Mario about last night at the deck, finding the texts, their subsequent breakup.
Ouch, Mario says. I'll point out that he's not good enough for you.
He was, though, Lisbeth says. She has a hard time understanding this herself, much less explaining it to someone else. What she had with JJ was real. Every minute together felt like an investment in their future. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, drives, walks, cocktail parties, meetings with food vendors, trips to the post office, ferry rides, the vacations to Bermuda and Napa and Jackson Hole, holidays with her family in Minnetonka and his parents in Binghamton, every movie they watched, every show they binged, every song they heard on the radio, every cookbook they tried a recipe from, every funeral they attended, there had been three, every wedding, six, every baptism, five, every beach day, every text and call, every trip to the Stop and Shop, every house they toured before buying the cottage on Bear Street, the fights and quarrels, the flat tires and dead batteries, the leaks in the ceiling and the power outages, and the day the fridge died, the football games, the concerts, Kenny Chesney, the Foo Fighters, Zac Brown, the burns and cuts in the restaurant kitchen, and the head colds and stomach bugs at home. All of these things had been like bricks in a fortress that was supposed to keep Lisbeth safe and happy for the rest of her life. She and JJ had inside jokes, secret code words, routines, and rituals. Lisbeth scratched JJ's back every morning. She knew where his spot was, southeast of the shamrock tattoo in the center of his back that was always extra itchy. On Sunday mornings in the winter, JJ would draw Lisbeth a bath, light her scented candles, and leave her a pile of food magazines. While she was in the tub, he would go to Nautilus to pick up Caleb's bagels with sriracha schmear, and they would eat in the kitchen, Lisbeth still in her bathrobe, while they listened to old Springsteen concerts. Those Sunday mornings were sacred, their version of church. Lisbeth had actually thought they would get married someday, despite their cool posturing. She wanted a marquise cut diamond. She wanted a ceremony on the beach at Maya Comet followed by a clam bake. She wanted to dance in her wedding dress at the Chicken Box.
They had talked about children. They wanted two. And when Lisbeth missed her period in January of 2021, they were both giddy and nervous. It wasn't exactly what they had planned. A baby arriving in September, Lisbeth hugely pregnant all through the summer season. But they both grinned like crazy, calling each other Ma and Pa, naming the baby Buddy. And when Lisbeth started to bleed at 9 weeks, they cried in each other's arms. The sexting with Christina had started that summer. JJ had bulldozed the fortress. Worse, he'd allowed Lisbeth to think that the fortress had existed only in her mind. The ending, rather than creating a stronger place that Lisbeth could launch from into a new, different, better quality life, was an obliteration, as though 15 years of Lisbeth's life, her prime years, 23 to 38, had vaporized. She couldn't salvage anything from them except the knowledge that she had, technically, survived. Lisbeth drinks what's left in her jelly jar and turns to Mario. You're how old? 40?
46.
Have you ever had your heart broken? Mario sighs.
Not like that. Not by a woman romantically. But when Fiona died.
Fiona Kemp, Lisbeth thinks. Chef of the Blue Bistro. She died of cystic fibrosis at the end of the 2005 season. It's Nantucket restaurant world legend.
And when the Blue Bistro closed, my heart broke. It's going to sound pompous as hell, but it was the dismantling of a dynasty. The bistro was the best, not because of the food or the location. It was the best because of the people. It was like a winning football team before the quarterback declares free agency and goes to a different team, or like those string of golden summers at sleepaway camp before you get your driver's license and a job making subs at Jersey Mike's. We all knew Fiona was terminally ill and that we were living on God's grace. But even so, when it ended, we were shell-shocked. The dream died with Fiona. A piece of all of us died with Fiona. So yes, I've had my heart broken by this island. So badly that I left for 17 years.
Mario takes Lisbeth's hand and leads her back to the railing. They watch the steamship ferry glide majestically out of the dock. It's all lit up, as big as a floating building. Mario puts his hands on either side of Lisbeth's face.
I'm going to kiss you now, but I think we should both be careful.
Lisbeth laughs. I'm never falling in love again, don't worry.
Okay then,
he says. And he leans in. The first kiss is just a brushing of lips, warm and soft. Then Mario pulls Lisbeth close enough that their hips lock. He kisses her again, and his lips linger on hers, but it's still tentative, like he's making a decision. With the third kiss, Mario's lips part, and their tongues touch, and a second later, they're kissing like a couple who were destined to fall in love despite their best intentions. Eventually, Mario leads Lisbeth to his bed, which is pleasingly and surprisingly firm. He takes his time undressing her. His fingertips graze her nipples back and forth, until she moans into his mouth. He kisses her under her ear, sucking a little, then whispering, "You are so beautiful to me, Lisbeth." She soon realizes there is no comparison between Mario and JJ in bed. JJ made love like a bull in a china shop, all power and bluster, no finesse. He liked to get it done as noisily and raucously as possible. Mario tends to her, he makes her ache. She wants him inside her, and just when she thinks she can't wait another second, she's a dish on the stove that's going to burn, he makes the next move. They rock together on the firm bed, and Lisbeth squeezes her newly powerful thighs around him, and he cries out. The surrender in his voice is something Lisbeth knows she'll replay in her head over and over again. He rolls off her, breathless. She's dazzled. "Why do we have to be careful again?" she says. He laughs.
"I was just wondering that myself."
He stares at the ceiling for a second, then he pushes himself up and kisses her.
I said that because I have only a one-season contract. And, as I'm sure you're aware, there are no guarantees the hotel is going to make it.
Lisbeth pulls back like he's run vinegar under her nose. The hotel is going to make it. She realizes she has no idea if this is true. Their occupancy, a month after opening, is right around 40%. Lisbeth is too busy with the day-to-day operations to fret about this like she did at the beginning. Is the hotel losing money? Yes. But will Xavier pull the plug after only 1 year? Would he spend all that money just to abandon it? He said he was trying to impress two women, and one of them is Shelley Carpenter. Who is the second woman? Lisbeth hasn't wondered about this for a while. She dearly hopes it's not Alessandra. The hotel is going to be in business next year if I have anything to say about it. The hotel is going to be just fine. Mario kisses the tip of her nose in a way that feels patronizing, and suddenly Lisbeth wants to swat him.
Okay, heartbreaker, he says.
He pulls on his boxers and a t-shirt from Cisco Brewers.
Come to the kitchen with me, please. I'm feeding you.
Chapter 14. A desk thing. It's the second Saturday of July, and the hotel has 3 checkouts and 4 check-ins. Alessandra can't believe the hotel isn't busier. If she'd known it was going to be this dead, she would have worked at the White Elephant. One of the check-ins is, thankfully, a man traveling solo named Dr. Romano. He has the chiseled good looks of a doctor on a soap opera. Dr. Romano is staying in a room, not a suite, and he's wearing a black titanium wedding band. But Alessandra chooses to overlook these two unfortunate circumstances and slips him her number. He tilts his head at her upside-down name tag and says, "Thank you very much, Alessandra." Outstanding, she thinks. He'll text her the second he gets to the room, she's sure of it. Edie, meanwhile, is trying to get the woman in room 110 a blowout at R.J. Miller. Forget it, they're booked solid, Alessandra thinks. She hasn't been able to squeeze anyone in there all summer. But then she overhears Lindsay at the salon granting a favor because it's sweet Edie Robbins calling. When Edie hangs up, Zeke wanders over to the desk and says, "How do you make room keys anyway? Is it like magic or something?" Edie takes a breath, no doubt to explain that it's magnetic, not magic, but Alessandra pipes up first. "It's a desk thing. You wouldn't understand." "Yeah, it's a desk thing," Edie says. She beams at Alessandra so earnestly that Alessandra cringes. Edie is desperate to bond, but no, sorry, Alessandra can't let that happen. A couple enter the hotel, loaded down with luggage and baby paraphernalia, a stroller, a car seat, a bulging diaper bag. "Gotta go," Zeke says. "It's a bell thing." Is it Alessandra's imagination, or has Zeke been lingering around the desk an awful lot? Before she can stop herself, she turns to Edie. "I think he likes you." Edie's eyes widen. "What?" "He's always hanging at the desk asking questions," Alessandra says. "Have you noticed?" "Yeah, he asked you why you wear your name tag upside down, and he asked you how to say checkout in Italian, and he asked you the strangest place you've ever had sex," Edie says. "He likes you." "I think he does that to make you jealous," Alessandra says, and she believes this. She's too much woman for Zeke, and he knows it. "I'm old enough to be his grandmother." Edie laughs and grabs her bag. "I'm taking lunch." She's leaving Alessandra with the onerous task of checking in the couple with the baby. They'll need a crib. They'll ask about laundry facilities and a babysitter, preferably someone with 6 references and 4 grown children of her own, so that they can have a nice quiet dinner at Galley Beach or the Chanticleer. Alessandra's phone, which she keeps stashed at the back of the shelf under her computer, buzzes with a text. That would be Dr. Romano. Alessandra is so pleased that she's able to give the approaching couple a nearly genuine smile. "Checking in?" The woman, who is wearing a clingy green knit dress that shows off her breastfeeding boobs as well as her impossibly flat stomach, gasps. "Allie Powell?" she says.
Alessandra freezes like an animal in the wilderness confronted with a predator, because anyone who uses Alessandra's childhood nickname is an existential threat. She focuses on the woman's face. Oh, God, she thinks. It's Duffy Beecham from high school, the friend whose father she seduced, Stanford professor Dr. Andrew Beecham. To Alessandra's knowledge, Duffy never found out about the affair. The reason why Dr. Beecham, Drew, was so eager to buy Alessandra a one-way plane ticket to Rome was that at some point, he realized Alessandra had the power to destroy his life. By the time Alessandra landed in Rome, Duffy was a sophomore at Pepperdine, lounging on the beaches of Malibu, dating aspiring movie execs. Their friendship had been winnowed down to the occasional text when one or the other of them was drunk and heard the Dave Matthews Band. Every so often, Alessandra stalked Duffy on Facebook and Instagram. Alessandra had nominal profiles on both, but never posted. Duffy had married a Silicon Valley executive. Alessandra's invitation to the wedding was delivered to her mother's home, but Alessandra, who was then living in Ibiza, told her mother to decline. She realizes only now that she never sent a present, which was maybe forgivable since she was overseas. Alessandra doesn't know the husband's name, though she'll find out in a few short moments. Duffy went to grad school to pursue a master's in social work. She had always been a do-gooder. Her senior service project was distributing blankets to the homeless in Oakland. There was a way, too, in which Duffy's do-gooding extended to her friendship with Alessandra. Duffy saw Alessandra as a project, a girl with no father and a shabby excuse for a mother. On her social media platforms, Duffy posted the predictable photos of apple picking with her husband. They wore matching sweaters. It was almost laughable. Waiting in line at Swan's Oyster Depot, a picturesque fog lying beneath the Golden Gate. A pork belly banh mi in the stands at a 49ers game captioned, "Only in San Francisco." And then later, she posted pics of their new apartment in Nob Hill, where she allowed her 537 followers to weigh in on decorating decisions. Wallpaper or paint for the powder room? Salvaged wood floors in the kitchen or chicer epoxy? Alessandra hadn't heard about the baby, so it must have been well over a year since Duffy has surfaced in Alessandra's consciousness. She should have been keeping track more closely, Alessandra realizes, so she was prepared for Duffy's trip to Nantucket. Duffy, Alessandra says, trying to tamp down all of these confusing thoughts. I can't believe it. You're staying here? Yes, Duffy says, for 3 nights. Are you working here? I am, Alessandra says, brightly stating the absolutely obvious. She won't let this be awkward, she thinks. Though it is. It is. Alessandra was the far superior student in high school, the original thinker with the uncanny ear for languages. She should be the bigger success. But as this situation painfully illustrates, she's just not. I'm the front desk manager. Duffy pushes the stroller toward the desk, and the husband jogs over after he finishes loading all the crap onto the luggage trolley that Zeke is holding steady. I thought you were in, I don't know, Saint-Tropez or something, living on some rich guy's yacht. That was the plan, Alessandra thinks. I lived in Europe forever, Alessandra says. Italy, most recently, but also Spain and Monaco. Honey, Duffy says to the husband, this is Allie Powell, my BFF from high school. Zeke is lingering over by the door with the trolley, listening to every word, Alessandra can tell. If Zeke tells Adam that she used to go by Allie, she'll never hear the end of it. The husband reaches across the desk to give Alessandra a strong Silicon Valley handshake with intentional eye contact. Jamie Chung, he says. Nice to meet you, Allie. Alessandra, she thinks, but she can't bear to correct him because she doesn't want to seem pretentious. I'll be checking you in, Alessandra says. I'll just need an ID and a credit card. Jamie Chung slides a California driver's license and a purple Reserve American Express card across the desk. So you know Duff from high school? Duffy swats him. We were best friends,
she says. We were inseparable. Allie practically lived at my house. She was the one who held my hair that time I got so drunk on tequila.
Aha, Jamie says. You're the reason my wife can't drink margaritas.
I didn't give her the tequila, Alessandra thinks. I held her hair. But again, she keeps quiet. My parents loved Allie, my mother especially. Duffy lowers her voice. She used to talk about adopting you. She wanted to give you a nice, normal home. Alessandra won't take the bait, won't mention that she had both a mother and a home, and she won't give in to her rogue impulse to lean across the desk and say to Jamie in a stage whisper, I had an affair with Duffy's father the spring of our senior year. Instead, Alessandra says, I'm going to comp your first night.
Oh my God, thank you, Duffy says. Aren't you just the summer Santa?
Ho, 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 Alessandra thinks. I never got you guys a wedding present, so. Duffy's brow wrinkles.
You didn't?
Alessandra shakes her head. Of course, Duffy wouldn't keep track of things like wedding presents. She might not even have set up a registry. She might have just asked guests to donate to Rosalie House. Though from the looks of her diamond ring, the Whopper diamond studs in her ears, and her Cartier tank watch, probably a push present. Oh, how Alessandra loathes this term. She might be more materialistic now than she was then.
How about upgrading us to a suite as well? Jamie asks, if you have one available.
They have 7 suites available, but Alessandra is so taken aback by Jamie's brazen request, it's a taser to her sensibilities, that she says,
It looks like the suites are all spoken for.
It's just with the baby, Jamie says.
This is Cabot,
Duffy says, pulling a cherubic little baby in a sailor suit from the stroller. Cabot Chung, Alessandra thinks. He's a beautiful kid, at that most photogenic age for babies. What is that, 6 months, 7? Alessandra waggles her fingers at him. She's so unmaternal that this feels campy, but she goes all in with her gushing while inwardly she fumes. She offered Jamie and Duffy a free night, but Jamie asked for more, so it feels like she hasn't given them anything at all. She makes a show of tapping on her keyboard. I'm going to work some magic and slide you into a suite after all, she says. I'll have Zeke set up a crib and baby-proof the room.
Thank you, Duffy says. You're amazing. Can we take you to dinner one night while we're here so we can catch up?
Alessandra peeks at her phone. There are 2 texts from a number she knows is Dr. Romano. I'm tied up all 3 evenings that you're here, she says. She activates the keys for Suite 216 and slides them across the desk. But I'm sure we'll find time to chat.
I can't wait to text my parents and tell them I saw you, Duffy says. They won't believe it.
Please give them my best, Alessandra says. Alessandra can't help but revisit the fraught months that she was sleeping with Duffy's father. Alessandra had been 18, which she thought was old enough, though now, nearly the same number of years later, Alessandra realizes it wasn't old enough at all. She had been a teenager and Drew a tenured professor in his mid-40s. However, Alessandra can't call herself a victim, even through the lens of 2022. She had always loved Drew, crushed on him, idolized him, seeing him as somewhere between an unattainable celebrity and a father figure. The Beechams owned an entire Victorian on Filbert Street that they'd inherited from Mary Lou's parents. Classical music always spilled from the tantalizing, slightly ajar door to Drew's study. NPR played on a radio in the kitchen where Mary Lou made the girls crepes for breakfast. For a weeknight dinner, she'd whip up Dover sole and frisé salad with lardon. Both Beecham parents read copiously. They subscribed to The Economist and the New York Review of Books. They attended the symphony. Alice Waters knew the Beechams by name, and they were always taking trips to Lisbon or Grenada, where Drew would lecture. They weren't wealthy, but they were rich, with intellect, with ideas, with experiences. Duffy, however, shared none of her parents' interests. She liked Britney Spears and Buffy the Vampire Slayer,
and she was as much of a troublemaker as Alessandra, if not more so. She was the one who became friends with HB, the guy who met them in the Presidio with a bottle of Don Julio that fateful night. Duffy matched HB shot for shot, but Alessandra tossed her shots over her shoulder because she didn't like the look of HB and didn't want to lose control. When Duffy started vomiting, Alessandra held her hair away from her face. It was 10 o'clock p.m. on a raw Friday in March, and they were sitting on the damp ground of Crissy Field. Alessandra wanted to leave, but Duffy couldn't make it three steps without doubling over and retching. Alessandra had no choice but to call Drew. The Beechams had been in the middle of hosting a dinner party. Candles glowed in the dining room. Bottles of excellent Napa Cabernet sat empty on the table. But the conversation and the laughing quieted when Drew ushered the girls past the dining room and down the hall to the kitchen. Mary Lou stood up from the table, making a joke about teenagers. "We all remember those days, right, Barry?" But when she saw the state Duffy was in, she flamed with anger, which she aimed at Alessandra, the unparented bad influence, until she realized that Alessandra was sober. For some reason, this served to make her even more livid, and she snapped at Drew to get Alessandra out of my sight. Drew drove Alessandra home. She was numb from Mary Lou's words. She felt like she'd been slapped. Until that moment, she had been something of a pet to Mary Lou. Drew tried to apologize. He thanked Alessandra for being a good friend. "You're a special young woman, Allie," he said. "You have a savageness to you. I mean that as a compliment. You'll get what you want out of this life." The street in front of Alessandra's building was dark and quiet. Drew shut off the car, which Alessandra found strange. "Don't you want to get back to the dinner party?" she asked. Drew leaned his head back against the seat. "God, those people are so dull," he said. "Barry Wilson was talking about annuities." He turned to Alessandra. "When did I become such an adult?"
"Are you worried about Duff?" Alessandra asked.
"She'll be fine," Drew said. "Tequila is its own punishment." Alessandra was about to reach for the car door and say, "Okay, thanks for the ride," but something about Drew was different. He was staring at her front door.
"Your mom's at work?" he asked.
They both knew the answer was yes. Alessandra nodded.
"Will you be okay by yourself?"
Alessandra had been staying by herself since she was 7 years old. She got the crazy idea that he wanted her to invite him inside. She leaned over, rested her hand lightly on his upper thigh, and kissed him. The kiss lingered. It was, to this day, the most romantic kiss of Alessandra's life.
"This is a bad idea," Drew said.
But the next second, he was opening his car door, and they were heading into her house. As much as Alessandra wants to dislike Jamie for shaming her into giving them a room upgrade, she has to admit that he seems to be an excellent father, husband, and guest. Zeke let it be known that Jamie tipped him $100 for baby-proofing the suite, and early on their first morning, Jamie comes down to the lobby with the baby so that Duffy can sleep in. Alessandra watches him chat with the other guests. Cabot falls asleep in his arms while Jamie plays Louie in chess. Louis wins. Alessandra is on high alert every time the elevator dings, and the instant she sees Duffy step off, she beelines for the break room. She feeds a dollar to the jukebox and chooses Kiss, Ozzy Osbourne, and Metallica, and then takes her angst. She can't believe Duffy Beecham is here haunting her, out on the pinball machine. She plays one game, then a second, then a third, high score, and then she hears Adam's voice sing out, "Alessandra, are you in here?"
"Hello,"
Alessandra says, tearing herself away from the machine, though she has already dropped a fourth quarter in.
"Girl, get back out there. Edie is three deep."
Alessandra hurries back out, and sure enough, Edie has a line at the desk, the first ever since the hotel opened.
"Sorry about that," Alessandra says.
"It's fine," Edie says. "I understand."
"You don't, though,"
Alessandra thinks.
Duffy stops by the desk a while later with Cabot, who's wearing a tiny bucket hat and a little bathing suit printed with sharks. "We're taking him to the family pool," Duffy says. "I'll put him down for a nap around 1 and then I'll come chat."
"Whatever works," Alessandra says.
She doesn't want to chat with Duffy. She doesn't want to talk about high school or hear about Drew and Mary Lou. From Duffy's Facebook, Alessandra knows that they've both put on 40 pounds and turned gray. And she doesn't want to learn about Duffy's fabulous San Francisco life with her successful husband and adorable baby. But what she really doesn't want is to be asked questions about herself. What were her years abroad like? Well, some of them were better than others. Alessandra held a string of jobs in beautiful hotels, and she dated different men, all of them wealthy, most of them married, one of them, the one Alessandra thought would be her husband, a financial criminal, none of them appropriate. And what is her life like here on Nantucket? Last night, she slipped into Dr. Romano's room. They ordered room service. Alessandra hid in the bathroom while it was delivered and had completely mediocre sex. And Alessandra left at 2 in the morning, emotionally numb. When Duffy swings by on her way back up to her room, she says, "I'll be back down in a little while. Jamie will stay in the room with Cabot so that we can talk." "Great," Alessandra says. Once Duffy is on the elevator, Alessandra releases a low moan and Edie says, "Why didn't you take lunch now? You can go for as long as you want. It's okay with me." Alessandra blinks. "Why are you being so nice to me?"
"I grew up on this island," she says. "I check the cars in the parking lot at the Stop and Shop before I go inside. There are old friends I would do anything to avoid."
Oh my God, Alessandra thinks. Edie does understand. She takes one of the hotel bikes, goes to Something Natural, and sits at a picnic table for 2 hours, reading the new Elena Ferrante novel. When she arrives back at the hotel, Edie says,
"You're safe. They went to the Oyster Catcher for a late lunch, and they're staying through sunset."
"Thank you," Alessandra says. Once Alessandra learns Cabot's schedule, she's able to avoid a conversation with Duffy on day 2 and day 3 as well. She owes Edie big time because she takes some seriously long-ass lunches, telling Duffy she has a doctor's appointment and then a Zoom meeting she can't miss. She blows Dr. Romano off on night 2. She needs sleep. But she visits him late on night 3. And after they've had more mediocre sex, Alessandra finds herself weeping uncontrollably. Dr. Romano, his name is Mark, thinks she's crying because she's become emotionally attached and he's leaving in the morning. Gently, he wipes her tears away with the pad of his thumb. He has lovely hands and even lovelier fingers. He's a surgeon.
"Please don't cry," he says. "We had a nice time together and that's what matters, right?"
Yes, of course, Alessandra will never see him again. He has a wife and 2 little girls in Kansas City, but that's not why she's crying. She shrugs.
"Is there anything I can do to make you feel better?"
"Just hold me," she says, snuggling into him. "And if you could write a review on Travel Tattler and mention me by name, that really helps. Just say I was exceptional on the desk or whatever."
He tickles her ribs. "You were exceptional on the desk."
He reaches for the remote control and turns on the TV. Caddyshack has just started.
"Have you ever seen this movie? It's a laugh riot."
Is there a man alive who doesn't think Caddyshack is a laugh riot? If so, Alessandra hasn't met him.
"I've never seen it," she lies. "Is it about golf?"
"Oh, just wait, he says. "That's the judge."
Alessandra closes her eyes.
"You're going to love it."
When Alessandra awakens, it's very late, nearly 3 a.m. The doctor is snoring beside her, and Alessandra slips from bed and gets dressed. She needs to get home. The good news is she can leave through the front doors rather than sneaking down to the lower level and going out the back because both Richie and Raul will be gone. But when Alessandra enters the lobby, she sees Raul just heading out. She comes to an immediate halt and ducks behind the corner, but he must sense something because he turns and sees her.
She's caught. Hey, he says. What are you doing still here? She cocks an eyebrow.
What are you doing still here?
He shakes his head. There was a domestic issue in Suite 216. I had to call the police.
Alessandra says, Suite 216? Did someone complain about the baby crying?
The baby was fine. It was the parents. They had dinner at the galley tonight, and then I guess they had drinks at Lola, whatever. They were all lit up, and they had a fight that got loud, and Suite 214 called down, and I went up first, but it was above my pay grade, so then Richie came up. The wife was crying and calling the husband a bastard, and he was calling her a psycho, and she said she didn't want him in their room. It was a mess. They pulled it together a bit when the cops showed up. It's fine now, and they're checking out in the morning, thank God.
You're sure the wife is okay? Alessandra says. He wasn't hitting her, was he?
The husband took me aside and said she's really not supposed to be drinking since she's nursing, but she made an exception because she's on vacation, and then she bumped into an old friend who really triggered her.
Triggered her?
That's what he said, yeah. And don't ask me to clarify. I'm 42 years old. I don't even know what that word means.
Raoul musses Alessandra's hair, which she's sure is already pretty mussed. Raoul is the only person on planet Earth she would allow to do this.
What are you doing here again? He asks.
Oh, you know me, Alessandra says. I can't get enough of this place. Later that morning, Alessandra places the folio for the Chung family in an envelope and hands it over with a smile. Sorry we didn't get a chance to catch up. Me too, so busy. The baby. This stupid thing called work, only get a day off every 2 weeks. So much fun. Thank you for hooking us up with the suite. Here's my number. Call if you ever get back to San Fran, and hey, friend me on Facebook.
I will, Alessandra says.
She won't.
Bye. Jamie and Duffy stroll cute baby Cabot right out the door.
And that, Alessandra thinks, is that. Except it's not. A few days later, Alessandra and Edie are powering up their computers and getting ready to start the day when Richie suddenly pops out of the back office, terrifying them both.
Whoa, Edie says. I thought there really was a ghost.
Richie doesn't seem amused, which is strange because normally he's happy-go-lucky and always has a dad joke ready. But he's clearly been here all night. Alessandra worked the graveyard shift her first few months in Lake Como. She understands how it splinters your nerves. He shakes a piece of paper at Alessandra.
You comped a night in a suite for a guest named Chung? No code, no explanation, and no sign-off.
I did, Alessandra says. She was so happy to have the Chungs gone. Duffy was triggered. Alessandra still hasn't processed that one. If either of them should have been triggered, it was Alessandra. And what was that crack about the nice, normal home? That she completely spaced on the fact that she would have to explain the comped night. The desk staff are allowed to comp a night if something goes wrong, if guests have an unusually bad experience, or if they can't check in until after 5 o'clock. But staffers are not allowed to do what Alessandra did and comp at will. Every single comp must be run past Lisbeth. Still, Alessandra had expected Richie to let it slide. He has never said a word about her taking $5 or $10 every few days from petty cash to pay for her lunch, though it's possible he doesn't know she does this. Is it really that big of a deal?
It was a $645 room rate, Richie says. That needs to be paid by you. You made a unilateral decision to comp the room.
Okay, Alessandra says. I'll point out that Edie upgraded the Marsh family for the summer without anyone's permission. That adds up to a lot more lost revenue than $645, and no one is making her pay. Both Richie and Edie are silent.
Richie huffs.
Fine. I'll let this go, but don't do it again, either of you.
He disappears back into Lisbeth's office. Alessandra turns to Edie. I should have just gotten them a toaster, she says. Edie gives Alessandra a withering look. I'm sorry, Edie, Alessandra says. She pauses. Is it a desk thing to throw your helpful, kind coworker under the bus?
your desk thing,
Edie says.
And Alessandra is more relieved than she can explain when Edie lets the tiniest smile slip.
Chapter 15. Behind Closed Doors. Adam drags Raoul into the break room, and Grace follows them because it looks like trouble.
We need to speak to Lisbeth about the schedule, Adam says. It's not fair that she switched our shifts. You need to talk to her. She likes you better.
I don't want to talk to her, Raoul says, because, believe it or not, I'm ready to stop working nights. I did it for an entire month. Now it's your turn.
You just want to spend all day with Zeke, Adam says.
Raoul blinks.
Or you do, and that's why you're kirking.
I hope you're not accusing me of anything, Adam says, because I don't need to remind you which one of us was caught making out with that busboy at Nikki Beach.
That was before we were even together, Raoul says. I've been faithful since our first date.
And working with Zeke isn't going to make me unfaithful. If you think that, then you have trust issues.
I have trust issues?
Do you have a thing for Zeke, Adam?
At that moment, the door to the break room swings open and Zeke steps in.
Adam, you're on tonight? I've got to bounce.
I'll be right here, Adam says, just chatting with my husband, whom I never see.
Zeke looks from Adam to Raoul and must sense something because he closes the door.
Why can't we work together? Adam says.
Zeke can work nights.
You know why we can't work together, Raoul says. George said he'd recommend to any future employer that we be scheduled opposite each other.
Well, I'm lonely. I made dinner plans with Alessandra 3 times and she ditched me all 3,
Adam says. Surprise, surprise, Grace thinks. There was Mr. Brownlee in 309, Mr. Yamaguchi in suite 215, and Dr. Romano in room 107.
I miss you. I miss you too, boo.
Suddenly, Adam and Raoul embrace and start kissing. Grace is delighted the fight is over and the making up has begun. She heads over to the jukebox and plays Take My Breath Away by Berlin, and then she lights up the pinball machine. The gentlemen don't even seem to notice.
Could Kimber Marsh be any more obvious? Grace wonders.
She comes down to the lobby, again at 1:15 in the morning, coincidentally after Adam has left and the blue bar has closed, again wearing her shorty pajamas, cardigan, and the hotel slippers.
Richie? Kimber whispers.
But Richie isn't at his usual post out front. Richie, Grace sees, is in Lisbeth's office with the door not only closed but locked. He's on his cell phone, forbidden at work unless you needed to conduct hotel business, having a terse conversation. What can Grace think but that he's speaking to his ex-wife? Who else would he be talking to at 1:15 in the morning? Then Grace sees what Richie has on the desk in front of him, and she hears what he's saying into the phone.
Oh dear, she thinks, this is what he's up to. What a disappointment.
Grace blows the paperwork off the desk in an attempt to be disruptive, but Richie doesn't seem to care. Then she tries to mess with the phone connection, but it's too late. The conversation is over. When Richie hangs up, he slumps back in his chair and grabs his head. There's a tap on the office door.
Richie?
The inevitable has happened, Grace thinks. Kimber has grown so comfortable at the hotel that she has crossed the border between guest and staff. She's behind the front desk, and now she's knocking on the office door. If it weren't locked, Grace suspects she would have marched right in and caught Richie at his odious business. Richie jumps to his feet, and Lisbeth's desk chair shoots back into the wall. Richie stuffs the paperwork into his pants pocket. He inhales a breath and exhales with a smile. He once again looks like the charming, affable dad everyone thinks he is.
Kimber, he says, opening the door, what's up?
Can't sleep, Kimber says.
She seems to realize she's crossed some kind of invisible line because she scurries out from behind the desk. She waves what looks like a piece of notebook paper.
Also, I wanted to show you something.
What Kimber wants to show Richie at 1:15 in the morning is an article Wanda wrote entitled "The Mystery of the Haunted Hotel." Richie reads it aloud.
"The Hotel Nantucket has been plagued. Is this supposed to be plagued? With difficulties for nearly a century. Girl sleuth Wanda Marsh has uncovered the reason. There's a ghost who inhabits the hotel's fourth floor storage room."
Richie stops.
"Did Wanda write this herself?"
"Edie helped her a little."
"The ghost is the spirit of Grace Hadley, a chambermaid who died in a fire in the summer of 1922 in that fourth floor closet."
Richie looks up.
"Is this true?"
"Wanda insisted we go to the Athenaeum to look it up. They had old issues of the Nantucket Standard on microfilm."
"Your kids are incredible," Richie says. "Louis is a chess prodigy and Wanda is a burgeoning detective and investigative reporter. My three spend all their time playing Fortnite and watching YouTube."
"Wanda told me that she asked the ghost to knock, and the ghost did."
"Well, that's exciting," Richie says.
He subtly plucks his shirt away from his body. His extracurricular activity in the back office has made him perspire.
"The thing is, she really believes it," Kimber says. "Shall we go up and check out the fourth floor storage room?"
Richie frowns. "I shouldn't leave the desk."
"It'll only take a minute."
"I can't afford to lose my job," Richie says.
"I'm beginning to think you don't like me," Kimber says. "You practically ran away from me the other night."
"I do like you,"
Richie says.
He reaches across the desk for Kimber's hand.
Is he being patronizing? Grace wonders.
"I have a lot going on in my personal life right now."
"You can tell me if you're not attracted to me," Kimber says. "I'll survive."
Richie lets go of Kimber's hand. He's not attracted to her, apparently. But then he comes out from behind the desk.
"I'm not the person you think I am," he says. "I know I put on a good act of being nice guy, Richie."
Kimber puts a finger to his lips.
"I'm probably not the person you think I am either," she says. "But it doesn't matter. It's summertime, and we're on an island 30 miles out to sea."
Richie gazes at Kimber. He seems to be deliberating, and Grace, quite frankly, is on the edge of her seat. Finally, Richie puts his arms around Kimber and pulls her close. Kimber raises her face. Richie takes his glasses off and sets them on the desk. A nice touch, Grace thinks. Things are about to get steamy, and kisses her. Grace cheers silently, even though she fears the relationship won't last. But who doesn't love a little summer romance? She just hopes they don't forget about that article. If they solve her murder case, she'll finally be able to get some much-needed rest. It has been an exhausting century. It's Friday, a day that used to mean only one thing for Chad, slightly more raucous partying than his usual weeknight partying. Chad hasn't heard from Bryce or Eric in weeks, though he did get a text from Jasper thanking him for being cool about me and Winston. Chad responded, "Hey man, I'm happy for you. If you ever want to grab a bite, hit me up." Jasper hasn't reached out yet, but he might somewhere down the road. Chad feels only relief at the disbanding of his group of friends. The solitude has turned out to be kind of nice. However, Chad is still desperately hoping for an email from Patty. When Chad logs into his Yahoo account first thing in the morning, he sees an alert that someone has hacked into the operating software of both the Steamship Authority and Highline Cruises. All ferry service to and from Nantucket is halted. When he goes downstairs, his mother has the local news on television.
"They'd better get this fixed pronto," Whitney says. "Dad is coming tonight."
Chad snaps to attention.
"He's coming tonight?"
"Yes, silly. His deal closed. He's driving up with the car for the rest of the summer," Whitney says. "Can I make you an English muffin? Or would you like a peach? They're ripe."
"I have to get to work," Chad says.
His mother still hasn't quite acknowledged the fact that Chad has a job. Whitney Winslow is an expert at ignoring the things that make her uncomfortable. She obviously knows that Chad works every day at the Hotel Nantucket, but that doesn't mean she has to talk about it. Chad wonders if she's told his father. Chad picks a peach out of the 2 dozen peaches piled in the fruit bowl. His mother has overshopped again, and half of these will rot. Chad grabs 2 more. He'll give them to Bibi, and she can take them home and make baby food or whatever. But when Chad gets to work, Bibi isn't there, and neither are Octavia and Paz, because there is no ferry service. Ms. English accepts Chad's offer of the 2 peaches with a bemused expression on her face and then pulls on a pair of rubber gloves.
It's just you and me today, Longshot.
You're going to clean the rooms? Chad asks.
Who else is going to do it? She asks. The cleaning fairies?
Chad assumes that he and Ms. English will split the rooms, but when Ms. English follows him to room 209, he understands they're going to deal with all the rooms together. They'll inspect the check-ins first. These rooms are clean, but they need to fill the minibars and run through the 100-point checklist anyway. Chad is nervous. What if he makes a mistake or forgets something and she fires him? He tries to pay extra attention and soon realizes that he has already been paying extra attention because every single day, he not only does his own job, but also keeps an eye on Bibi to make sure she doesn't steal anything. The work goes quickly. Ms. English sings softly. She has a beautiful voice and sends Chad down to the Blue Bar kitchen to get the goodies for the minibars. Down there, Chad bumps into Yolanda, the super hot wellness guru. She's leaning up against one of the prep tables, eating an acai bowl topped with perfect circles of banana and strawberries and talking to Beatrice, who's over by the ovens.
Hey, Chad,
Yolanda says, and Chad nearly drops to his knees. Hot Yolanda knows his name.
Hey, Chad says as casually as he can.
He goes to the walk-in for the bluefish pâté, then to the pantry for the crackers, then to a special fridge for the beer and wine. He has to write down exactly what he takes in the log for obvious reasons. When he comes out with everything in his blue plastic handbasket, it's hard to be sexy while carrying a handbasket, but Chad tries anyway. Beatrice is slicing into one of the baguettes that she just pulled out of the oven.
Stick around, she says to Chad. I'm going to blow your mind.
Yolanda giggles.
Don't tease him, Bea.
Not teasing, Beatrice says.
She slathers 2 slices of the warm bread with butter from a crock,
churned this myself,
lays pieces of paper-thin watermelon radish.
These were picked this morning at Pumpkin Pond Farm, across the top, and sprinkles the radish with sea salt.
Beatrice hands 1 piece to Chad and 1 to Yolanda.
Thank you, Chad says, and he takes a bite.
The bread with the crunchy crust and the sweet, creamy butter and the peppery zing of the radish combine in a way that nearly brings Chad to tears. Yolanda makes a loud, uninhibited moaning noise that sounds sexual, and Chad feels a stirring in his pants. They are teasing him, but Chad doesn't mind. It's the first semi-normal response he's had to anything since May. Chad and Ms. English make their way briskly through the check-ins, but the check-outs are another story. Chad and Bibi always rate the rooms on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being a room that looks like it's barely been occupied. Bibi is amused by people who go to the trouble of making the bed before they leave, and 10 being an apocalyptic disaster. Most rooms fall between a 4 and a 6, but naturally, on the day that Chad and Ms. English work alone, all 5 checkouts are a 10. When they walk into room 308, Chad nearly gags. Not only is the place a horrendous mess, but it reeks. Chad vaguely remembers a pleasant-looking young couple with infant twins being this room. There were 2 cribs shoehorned into the far corner, and in 1 crib is a dirty diaper lying wide open. Chad hurries to roll it up and throw it away, but the trash can is overflowing with dirty diapers as well as empty bottles of formula that smell like rancid milk. This couple left food all over the desk and dresser, granola bars, scattered almonds, a container of tuna salad that has, unfortunately, been sitting in the sun. There are ants everywhere. Most of the bed linens are in a heap on the floor, and the fitted sheet is stained with something brown. Chad finds half a melted Mounds bar under a pillow. That the stain is probably chocolate comes as a relief. Someone must have showered with the door open because the bathroom floor is a lake, and two of the thick Turkish towels are floating in it like islands. The father shaved in the sink and didn't bother to clean out his whiskers, which for some reason is the thing that grosses out Chad the most. He turns to Ms. English, aghast. He can't believe people aren't more considerate. He has a hazy understanding that twins are a lot of work, but don't the parents realize someone has to clean this up? A human being? He feels like he should apologize to Ms. English, like the state of the room is somehow his fault. He realizes how much he misses working with Bibi. If she saw this, she would call the guests every profane word she knows, and she knows a bunch, and they would both feel better. Ms. English merely snaps on a new pair of gloves. Okay, long shot, she says. Let's get to work. 30 minutes later, the room is sparkling clean. There are fresh sheets on the bed, the cribs have been broken down and stored, the rug has been vacuumed, the food remnants have been thrown away and the ants along with them. The puddle in the bathroom is mopped up, the towels have been replaced, the sink, tub, and toilet are scrubbed. The minibar has been emptied, cleaned, and restocked. The hangers have been counted, the robes placed on the back of the bathroom door, the blow dryer checked, the bottles of shampoo, conditioner, and lotion refilled. It's so satisfying, Chad thinks, restoring this room to glory. He's almost glad he's no longer friends with Bryce and Eric because they wouldn't understand this feeling. Patty might understand. In the summers, he ran a lawn mowing business in his hometown of Grimesland, North Carolina. He kept a push mower in the back of his Ford Ranger and drove to his clients' homes, most of them ranches or salt boxes that would fit into Chad's living room, and cut the grass, $15 for front and back. He did 5 or 6 lawns a day and put all his money in the bank, so he'd have it to spend at Bucknell. But even then, he had to be careful, and sometimes he stayed home rather than go out to Bull Run, although Chad always offered to spot him. Chad closes his eyes. The best part about working with Bibi is that he never has time to think about Patty or wonder if Patty is healed enough to go back to mowing lawns and look over the grass, striped with diagonal lines, and feel proud of his handiwork. Normally, Chad is done with work around 5, but today he and Ms. English don't finish until after 6. Lisbeth has let them know that the boats are up and running again, and there are some pretty unhappy people waiting in the lobby for their rooms to be ready. From the 5 checkouts combined, there are $65 in tips, which Ms. English presses into Chad's hand despite his protests. I don't want it, he says. You take it. This makes Ms. English laugh. Don't be ridiculous, Longshot. Chad stuffs the bills into the front pocket of his khakis. I'll give it to Bibi tomorrow. To Bibi? Ms. English says. She didn't earn it. She got a day off. But she needs it, Chad thinks. I hope you and Bibi aren't getting romantically involved, Ms. English says. I don't want to have to worry about you two alone in the rooms. Chad feels his face redden. The idea of fooling around with Bibi in one of the rooms makes him very uncomfortable. He wishes Ms. English hadn't said that. He's afraid it will be all he thinks about tomorrow, and if he's awkward around Bibi, she'll notice. No way, he says. Nothing like that. But you brought her peaches, Ms. English says, and she winks. Chad has no interest in going home to face his father, so he delays the inevitable with a drive through town. It's a summer evening on Nantucket, and there are couples strolling into galleries for openings, and a well-dressed mob crowding the hostess lectern at the boarding house. Chad sees a group of, well, for lack of a better term, Chads walking right down the middle of the street, cutting off traffic without any consideration for the drivers, heading, he's certain, to drink at the gazebo, where they will order their vodka sodas and talk trash about their father's boats, their golf handicaps, and girls. Chad used to be one of those guys, but he isn't any longer, and he's glad. He loops around and heads for home. He's driving out Eel Point Road when something catches his eye. It's the gunmetal gray Jeep Gladiator that Ms. English drives, parked in the driveway of number 133. The house is huge, even bigger than the Winslows' home, and it's closer to the water. Chad slows down. He's pretty sure his parents considered buying number 133 as an investment property and renting it out for 50 or 60 grand a week until they eventually gifted it to Leith or Chad. He watches Ms. English climb out of the Gladiator. He comes to a stop and nearly calls to her. His Range Rover is hidden by the tall, decorative grasses around the mailbox. What is Ms. English doing at number 133? A dude wearing a Panama hat and a wheat-colored linen suit comes out of the house and shakes Ms. English's hand. He holds open the door and she steps inside. Chad takes a beat to absorb this. Ms. English must be interviewing to clean number 133, a side hustle. Chad drives off, feeling queasy, and the worst is yet to come. When Chad pulls into his own driveway, he sees his father's Jaguar. He finds Paul Winslow on the back porch in a rattan chair, sunglasses perched on top of his bald head, eyes closed, gin and tonic on the table next to him. He's dressed in shorts, a polo shirt, and topsiders, which is what he wears all summer long except when they go out for dinner. For that, Paul favors pants printed with whales, lobsters, or flamingos. Chad gets it. His father works in the pressure cooker environment of venture capital, and these 6 weeks are his time to relax. If Paul lets off steam by wearing flamingo pants, fine. He deserves to enjoy the things his money has bought: the pool, their private beach, the view of Nantucket Sound. Chad doesn't hear anyone else in the house, and he realizes his mother's Lexus wasn't in the driveway. He takes a step backward, and Paul's eyes open.
"Hey, hey, hey, son," Paul says, rising to his feet and offering a hand as though Chad is a client. "I've been waiting for you. Where have you been?"
"Hey, Dad," Chad says. He feels like a bluefish gutted with a gaffe. What he wouldn't give to wriggle free of this moment.
"Where are Mom and Leith?"
"They're at the salon," Paul says, "getting gussied up for dinner."
Dinner, Chad thinks. In the garden at the Chanticleer, which is their tradition the first night Paul arrives on island. Chad completely spaced about it. He can't believe things in their family have just gone back to normal after what happened in May, but maybe enough time has passed that they all feel they can just move on. Or his parents do. Leith will hate him forever, he's pretty sure.
"I was at work, actually," Chad says. "I got a job at the Hotel Nantucket, cleaning rooms."
His father's face shows no surprise, so Chad's mother must have prepped him. Paul sits and extends a hand to indicate that Chad should take the seat next to his.
"Let's talk that through for a minute, shall we?"
Paul's tone of voice has switched to executive mode, and seeing no option, Chad sits.
"Can I get you a beer, son?"
"No, thank you."
Paul chuckles. "Don't tell me you're on the wagon. If your mother and I thought you needed rehab, we would have sent you to rehab."
"No," Chad says, though he hasn't had a drink since that fateful night.
"But I'm all set for right now."
Paul sits in a pose of introspection, leaning forward in the chair, elbows on his knees, fingers tented, head bent.
"So what I'm hearing you say is that you got a job."
"Yes," Chad says, "at the Hotel Nantucket, cleaning rooms. I work for the head of housekeeping, Ms. English, who's an extremely cool person. There were three girls, women, I mean, on the crew with me. They all live on the Cape and commute over and back every day. So, because the boats weren't running earlier today, it was just Ms. English and me, which is why I'm late. I usually finish around 5.
Paul nods along to all this, a signal that he's listening. "I just closed a $5 billion deal. Do you have any idea why I work so hard, Chadwick?"
Chad isn't sure how to answer.
His father's not brokering peace in the Middle East or curing childhood cancer or teaching undergraduates the novels of Toni Morrison. He's betting on the success of ideas, technology, natural resources. Every once in a while, this does the world some good. His firm buys a pharmaceutical company that brings out an important drug or backs a fledgling company that does something to improve people's lives. But mostly, Chad understands, Paul is playing a game on an exclusive field, which results in a lot of winning, a lot of money. "Because you like it?" Chad says. This elicits a patronizing laugh.
"I do it to provide for you and your sister and your mother."
Paul raises an arm theatrically.
"I didn't grow up with any of this."
Right, Chad knows. His father comes from a regular background, though not one as impoverished as he might like people to believe. He grew up in a split-level house in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, which is close to the main line but pointedly not on it. It was Chad's mother, Whitney, who had the sterling pedigree, an estate in St. David's, private school at Baldwin, a father who was a managing partner at Rawl & Henderson, the definition of a Philadelphia lawyer. Paul met Whitney at a bar called Smoky Joe's on Route 30 when she was at Bryn Mawr and Paul was a scholarship student at Haverford. It was Whitney's father who helped Paul get into the business school at Wharton and then introduced him to the gentleman at the Brandywine Group. "I know," Chad says.
"You have the rest of your life to work," Paul says. "I thought we agreed that you would take the summer off to enjoy yourself."
Chad feels a lump in his throat. "I don't deserve to enjoy myself."
"I thought we agreed, as a family, to put what happened behind us."
"I can't just put it behind me, Dad," Chad says. He seeks out Paul's eyes. His father is essentially a decent guy who knows the difference between right and wrong. The mandate to keep what happened a secret is coming from Chad's mother. She has her reputation to think of. It's bad enough that so many people at home know. Whitney Winslow doesn't want her social circle on Nantucket whispering about it as well. "Have you heard from the lawyers?" Chad swallows. "Or Patty's family?"
"Yes," Paul says.
He exhales like he's about to deadlift 300 pounds.
"The surgery was unsuccessful. Patrick lost sight in the eye permanently."
Patty O'Connor, Chad's best friend from college, his best friend possibly ever in his life, is blind in his left eye. Permanently. Chad feels blinded himself. He bends over his knees.
"We're offering a generous settlement, paying all the medical bills in addition to compensation for the eye."
How much is an eye worth? Chad wonders. What is the value of a full field of vision when you meet the woman you want to marry or hold your newborn child for the first time? Or when you go to MoMA to see Van Gogh's Starry Night or watch the sunset in the evening? Half of Patty's eyesight is gone. He can still see, but Chad looked this up right after the accident. He'll lose depth perception, and he'll have difficulty judging distance and tracking moving objects.
"I want to contribute," Chad says. "That's very generous of you, son, but—"
Chad pulls the $65 out of his pocket and slaps it on the table next to Paul's gin and tonic. He has nearly $4,800 saved from his paychecks. He'll give everything he makes this summer to Patty. The amount will be dwarfed by whatever Paul has offered, but Chad wants Patty to know that he didn't just roll over on his beach towel, beer in his hand, joint between his lips, and let his parents handle this. He went out and got a job where he deals with other people's dirty diapers and forgotten late-night candy bars and bathroom swamps. Paul eyes the money.
"I'd like you to give your notice at the hotel tomorrow."
"No," Chad says.
"Your mother doesn't like how it looks," Paul says. "You working as a menial laborer."
"Menial?" Chad says. "I have another word for it. Honest. It's an honest job. Cleaning rooms for people who work hard themselves and who come to Nantucket to relax and have a vacation. You haven't seen these rooms, Dad. They're every bit as nice as the rooms in this house. The hotel is a special place."
"That isn't exactly what your mother has heard."
"It doesn't matter," Chad says. He realizes now why his father works so hard. It has nothing to do with the pool or the Range Rover or a bowl filled with ripe peaches. It's so he can control people. I could be working at a roadside motel on Route 000 in Nowheresville, and the work would still be noble. People's lives include messes, and I'm cleaning them up.
You're to give your notice tomorrow, Chadwick, Paul says.
Chad stands up.
Or what? You'll ground me? Throw me out of the house? Disown me? Don't be ridiculous. You're the one who's being ridiculous, Chad says.
What kind of parents don't want a child to actually take responsibility for his actions? His parents. Which is why he made such careless, thoughtless mistakes in the first place. His mother and father raised him to believe that he was invincible. They raised him to believe that nothing bad could ever happen in his life. But it did.
I won't quit, Chad says. I'm not a quitter.
July 11th, 2022. From Xavier Darling, xd@darlingent.com.uk. To employees of the Hotel Nantucket. Good morning. I think we can all agree the summer is now in full swing. Once again this week, the reviews reflect an exceptional job done by our front desk manager, Alessandra Powell, and this week's bonus goes to her. I hope the rest of you will strive to follow Alessandra's excellent example of service. Thank you for your continued hard work. XD.
Edie is in the break room with Zeke when the Venmo alert comes into her phone, so she ignores it. She and Zeke have become friendly, and Edie isn't going to let anything interrupt their bonding time. She spent all of her awkward freshman year of high school and at least half of her slightly less awkward sophomore year stalking Zeke English both in person and online. So the fact that they are now sitting next to each other at the Formica counter eating ice cream with their thighs practically touching is nothing short of miraculous to Edie in a long-delayed dream kind of way. Zeke says exactly what Edie is thinking.
I can't believe Alessandra won the money again this week. It's starting to feel like a setup.
Edie makes a non-committal murmuring noise, though what she wants to do is emphatically agree. Something must be up with Alessandra. She's good on the desk, no question, but she doesn't go the extra mile the way Edie does. If a guest requires an extra pillow or towel or a second container of the smoked bluefish pâté, Edie zips directly up to the room and hands it over with a bright and sincere smile. She has learned the first names of everyone who answers the phone at crew in order to secure hotel guests what is, for most people, an impossible reservation. She even went so far as to buy the little boy staying in room 302 a lighthouse keychain from the hub because he was obsessed with Brant Point Light. Edie used her own money, of which she has very little, not the hotel's petty cash, which is what Alessandra uses to buy herself lunch. Petty cash is not to be used for their personal expenses.